Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to a special edition of Film Sociology here at WFYI 90.1 FM in Indianapolis. I'm your host, Matthew Sosi. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msosi, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. I call it a special film sociology because it's a special two-part edition of the show, which means we're not reviewing anything new this week. However, I am going to be playing part one of an epic chat I had earlier this year with John Krull, the host of No Limits. We break down the films of Elvis Presley, and moderating, well, yelling out the titles so we can talk about them, is McKenna Mays, film sociology correspondent emeritus, alumni emeritus. So we'll get to that in a little bit, but I didn't get a chance to do this last week, and I deeply apologize, but I need to raise a glass and salute to fellow film critic Bonnie Britton, who passed away last week at the age of 68, known for her work from the Indianapolis Star from 1984 to 2007. She did her job well. She was a lovely lady to sit next to at the theater and watch movies. And anyway, she will be missed. So thanks, Bonnie. Thank you for being kind to a young knuckleheaded film critic like myself. And then before we get to the Elvis stuff, yes, on the Blues House Party, you will be hearing a tribute to Matt Guitar Murphy. But, of course, we have to do a film sociology tribute to Matt Guitar Murphy because if anything else, he has, well, in the one, his finest moment in cinema, not including his performances in the Blues Brothers as a musician, as well as Blues Brothers 2000, unless we talk about that. But I got to interview Matt twice, once for WCRD Radio at Ball State and once for the King Biscuit Times. And he was nice enough to give me a show ID for WCRD, which if you see me on the street, I'll tell you about it sometime. But he's one of the few men that actually said shut up to Aretha Franklin and live the tale of the tale. And it happens in this scene from the Blues Brothers. Salute to you, Matt Guitar Murphy.
We got two honkies out there dressed like Hasidic diamond merchants.
Say what?
They look like they're from the CIA or something.
What they want to eat?
The tall one wants white bread, toast, dry, with nothing on it.
Elwood.
And the other one wants four whole fried chickens and a Coke.
And Jake, the Blues brother. Hi, Jake.
Matt!
Hi, Elwood.
What are you doing?
How you doing? How was Joliet?
Oh, it's bad. Thursday night, they serve a wicked pepper steak.
Can't be as bad as the cabbage rolls at the Terre Haute Federal Pen.
Or that oatmeal at the Cook County Slammer.
Oh, they are all pretty bad.
Matt, me and Elwood, we're putting the band back together. We need you and Blue Lou.
Oh, man, don't talk that way around here. My lady, she'll kill me.
Ma'am, you gotta understand that this is a lot bigger than any domestic problems you might be experiencing.
Matt, what the hell is he talking about?
Don't get riled, sugar.
Don't get riled, sugar me. Now, you're not going back on the road no more, and you ain't playing in them old two-bits, sleazy dives. You're living with me now. And you're not gonna go sliding around with your old white hoodlum friends.
But babes, this is Jake and Elwood, the Blues Brothers.
The Blues Brothers? They still owe you money, fool.
Ma'am, would it make you feel any better if you knew that what we're asking Matt here to do is a holy thing?
You see, we're on a mission from God.
Don't you blaspheme in here. Don't you blaspheme in here. Now, this is my man. This is my restaurant. You two are going to just walk right out that door without your dry white toast, without your faux fried chickens, and without Matt Guitar Murphy.
Now, you listen to me. I love you, but I'm the man and you are the woman, and I'll make the decision concerning my life.
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your actions.
Oh, shut up, woman.
Yes, an edited scene from the Blues Brothers featuring Matt Guitar Murphy, who died last week at the age of 88. Thanks, Matt, for your guitar work and for that just ridiculously fun moment in the diner with Aretha Franklin. Okay, what you're about to hear is part one of a very long chat I had earlier this year with John Krull, the host of No Limits. Big Elvis fan, John is, and I like to think I kept up with him a little bit. But anyway, we'd been talking about doing this show for a while, probably not on No Limits, and as it turned out, we talked so much, I had to split it into two parts. So John and I, along with McKenna Mays, who was our moderator, we decided to break down every single Elvis film. Yes, all the features and the two documentaries, and we talk a little bit of some other stuff. But hope you enjoyed this, and if you haven't seen any Elvis movies, well, grab a notebook and figure out which ones you want to check out. So, ladies and gentlemen, strap it down. This is going to be a bumpy ride, a fun bumpy ride. Here is part one of my Elvis film discussion with No Limits host, John Krull. Enjoy. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special edition of Film Sociology. John Krull, the host of No Limits, is here with me, as well as McKenna. And we are going to break down for you, the Film Sociology Public Radio listener, every film Elvis Presley ever made. So get ready, get your notebooks, find your top three. We're going to start at the very beginning. But I guess I should start with John. Where did your Elvis fandom begin?
Well, it was odd. It started when I was a small child. And I'm going to date myself here. The producers
know. You didn't see Ed Sullivan.
No, I did not. But this is in Marion, Ohio, where my family was living at the time when I was about 8 years old. It was the first time I was allowed to stay up late on a Friday night to watch a movie, and it was an Elvis movie, Tickle Me.
Oh, Jesus.
Which, again, though, there's an interesting story there. And, you know, from that point on, I was interested in it. And, you know, as I grew older, I really became fascinated by his music and his range as a performer.
Yep. I thank/blame my mother. She was a huge Elvis fan. I remember being the one to tell her that there was a breaking news story back in 77 when he passed. I've always said that besides Elvis being one of the great entertainers, period, he's also one of the great show business what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he
as much as he accomplished, there's a whole lot more, whole other levels
if
there.
If he had bopped Colonel Parker on the head and actually toured the world and had rights to his songs and made maybe a third less films, I mean, the possibilities were kind of endless in his case.
Yeah, and I assume that's the sort of stuff we're going to talk about. But it sort of culminated, too. You mentioned him dying in 77. My other great connection is I saw the last show.
Yes, you did.
I was there at Market Square Arena.
Willie Mays with the Mets?
Yeah. Well, actually, my take on that was different because I went in there, you know, I knew he, even I think I was 18 at the time, not quite 18. I went to the show realizing, okay, this guy's not 22 years old anymore. He's not the hillbilly cat. He's not any of those things. And I've got to say, the performances I recall of him singing couple of the later songs, Hurt and Bridge Over Troubled Water, mm-hmm. were incredibly moving, incredibly powerful performances. Did he walk through a lot of the early hits? You bet.
Oh, yeah.
You bet.
1 minute, 20 second versions of Hound Dog.
Yeah, yeah. And you could tell he was bored with it, mm-hmm. but which became kind of a, you know, is a theme we probably will explore
right.
in the discussion here,
well,
too.
My only comparison, I think, of that, I never got to see him. We had a chance to get tickets to see him New Year's Eve 1976.
Oh, the famous
at
show
the Pontiac
there, yeah.
Silverdome, and it just did not happen.
Yeah.
But I think of like when I saw Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry at the Chicago Blues Festival. This was in the late 90s, early aughts, and when they were on, they were on. And if they weren't, it was like Shaq at the free throw line. It was, you know, a very loud clang. So mm-hmm. you kind of had to take the bitter with the sweet, I guess, in those cases.
Yeah. The difference between Elvis and Chuck is that I remember seeing a Chuck Berry show where literally he put down his guitar and started berating the audience.
Yeah,
Elvis never crossed that line.
Although, if you go on YouTube, there are some rants.
Yeah.
There are. But, they never...
Not rarely directed toward the audience.
No, they were toward the evil media that
yeah.
is us.
Yeah.
But those somehow did not wind up on the RCA album, Having Fun with Elvis on Stage. Ladies and gentlemen, there is an entire RCA album of Elvis talking to the audience.
Saying thank you. Thank you very much, basically.
For 38 minutes.
Yeah, it's really not memorable. So.
And if you look at those 70s albums, that's saying a lot. So.
Yeah, well, and that illustrates one of the problems. My understanding of that, too, is that wasn't technically an RCA thing.
Oh.
The Colonel put that out through his own label as a side deal to make money himself, in part because he was, you know, if the reporting I've read is accurate, he was deeply in hock in Vegas because of his gambling problem. So.
Yeah.
So
anyway, all right, with that in mind, let's start to break down the entire Elvis filmography. You're welcome. McKenna, start us off. Where we begin? I know where we're beginning, but you're moderating this, so go ahead.
All right, we're going to start off with 1956, Love Me Tender.
Well,
it was not an Elvis vehicle. It turned into one.
It did, in part because they wanted to graph some songs onto it.
It was, I think, the Reno Brothers was the original title.
It was the original title. And, you know, the amazing thing there is that it really was sort of a B-Western that became this huge cultural phenomenon at the time because he was so big. You know, that's something in this age that we have trouble capturing because our media, our culture, all of that have become much more fragmented,
yep.
much more compartmentalized. We can't even process something as big as Elvis or the Beatles anymore. In 1956, the year that Love Me Tender came out, he sold one out of every 9 records sold in the world.
Period. Fathom that.
Yeah.
That's like saying, you know,
yeah.
1956 dollars.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, it's huge, which means that I can't even think of, you'd have to combine about 6 or 7 different performers to have that impact now.
I think an attempt where they tried to do that, and this is a bad example, but it's being able to cash in on something, is something like from Justin to Kelly.
Yeah.
The American Idol beach movie, because American Idol at that time was red hot, and they tried to capsize on that, and the results were mid-60s level at best, and that's not a compliment.
Yeah. The amazing thing, and you see all of really the good stuff and the bad stuff that would come from that first performance. I mean, there is a tremendous presence on
yes.
the screen. You cannot avoid watching the guy. When he's there, you can tell he is untrained as
yep.
an actor,
or it was really raw.
Yeah,
and he loved yeah. James Dean. He thought he could be or want to be like a James Dean type actor. Came
yeah.
close a couple times, but
he did. And
we'll get to those.
But in some of it though, even that was sort of a false trail for him because,
yep.
Dean was Dean, and he had his own private demons and all of that sort of stuff that he was able to communicate. you know, Elvis's gifts were a little bit less tortured than Dean's. He was somewhat less confused, I think. And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, places where he had success was really blazing his own trail, not trying to be an imitation. You know, you look at the music, he takes a Big Boy Crudup song, and you listen to the original, and you listen, it's not, you know, it's not an imitation of the blues.
No.
He's made it something else entirely different. And, you know, by trying to be James Dean, he was working himself into a box when a large part of his career was about kicking the walls of the box down.
Very good. Exactly. And it's a good Western. It's a decent Western. It's more interesting when he's, like you said, when he's on screen because of that dynamic and what he
Richard,
was going to do.
Richard Egan does not really radiate magnetism.
Exactly. All right. I don't have a bell. I don't have a chime, but here we go.
Okay.
All right. Next.
Right. 1957. Loving You.
And this is like this is one of the quintessential 50s kind of troubled teen films, because now you had films like Rock Around the Clock and, you know, where you were incorporating rock and roll music into movies. And I mean, and this would go even further in the late 60s. But the troubled teen who becomes a star, and he winds up doing a couple of these. But this one's, I like this one as well.
Well, and really, this one and then the next two, Jailhouse Rock and King Creole, are in some ways variations of his own story.
Yes.
You know, it's about Elvis by another name becoming Elvis, you know, becoming
the capital E,
the star. The thing that I find interesting about Loving You is I think that is most likely the closest we got on screen to what the stage performances were like at the time, to what, because even in Jailhouse Rock or King Creole, the performances are highly stylized.
Yes.
You know, in part because there were Hal Cantor, I think, actually, who directed Loving You, saw it as part of his mission to capture some of the Elvis phenomenon. He went down there, and I think he lived with Elvis for about a week and drove around with him and saw some of the performances and thought, okay, I want to capture as much of this energy as I can get on screen. So that's what makes it interesting. And then the other model that disappeared, I think, later in the film careers, there's a solid supporting cast there too. Some very talented, Elizabeth Scott, you know, Wendell Corey, you know, talented people.
And we're going to get to those, especially especially when we get into the 60s, about who he had coming off the bench.
Yeah.
I like to mix my sports with my arts. All right.
Yeah.
Next.
Same year, 1957, Jailhouse Rock.
Not a bad year.
No.
Of course, the famous title track, which he did the choreography for, although he never had stage
stage. They said that. But it actually had been choreographed. The choreographer said, "Show me some of the moves you use on stage, and then I'll build a routine."
So he gets the second half of the "and" credit.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, and it's also one of the few, if not the only, Elvis performance or movie where for the bulk of the film he's supposed to be deliberately unlikable.
Right.
You know, he is a hardened jerk through much of the movie, and that you know, in some ways that becomes a theme in the films too, that the bad boy has to be tamed.
I have to kill my phone.
That's
This is actually happening as we know it. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
You were saying, John, so sorry.
That's okay.
This is your pledge dollars at work, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I say, he was the bad boy who had to be tamed. And to me has been one of the weaknesses of that film, is that it is a surly kind of drama with some great songs, perhaps if not the greatest score in the Elvis film canon, certainly one of them. And then at the end, it gets really, really saccharine. So,
yeah, it's still a 50s film.
It is, yeah.
All right. Next.
1958, King Creole.
This is probably my favorite.
It is mine, too.
It is directed by Michael Curtiz, the man who gave us Casablanca, among other things. You have Carolyn Jones, Walter Matthau, Vic Morrow. That's a strong supporting group.
Dean Jagger.
It's about as close to noir as Elvis is going to get. And same thing. Kind of a troubled guy who becomes a singer but gets pulled into the seedy underworld of show business in New Orleans. And it's the combination of, I think, his acting and music performances are some of the best.
Yes, I would agree that, the reason I was chuckling is I remember when I was in grad school and talking with some friends who were film buffs too, and they made reference to the fact that Michael Curtiz directed this one and talked about Casablanca and Yankee Doodle Dandy, and then I said King Creole, and history will have to judge which was the best. At which point the conversation just descended from there.
And Milos Forman directed Hair.
So. But this one, I think, is also part of what the music is fabulous. The supporting performances are really exceptionally strong. It's also, I think, the most vulnerable we ever see Elvis on camera. There is a part of him, in part because he wanted to project that tough guy, surly. He wanted to be, Dean or Brando, and I don't think he necessarily saw the vulnerability in either of those actors, too. But he wanted to project that kind of masculinity that he didn't do wounded all that often or do it all that well.
Right.
And in this, we see that. We see regret. And, of course, Curtiz makes beautiful use of the New Orleans location.
And that was a film I think around the same time, Panic in the Streets was a film that was shot down there. Also beautiful black and white. But that was a city that wasn't, I don't think, utilized as much cinematically then.
Well, and I love that opening scene where he's standing on the balcony in the French Quarter and they sing the song Crawfish. But there is just something about it that is so evocative and so hypnotic almost.
And I think if he had, we can break down Colonel Parker, who to blame on where the path could have gone cinematically, but that was a pretty high point. And
he was poised for a major film career at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so with that in mind, next.
1960 G.I. Blues.
Okay. Yeah.
This is where it begins to jump the rails.
Because we have to make fun of him being in the army and Juliet Prowse is in it. So by this point we get to how good is the female, and that's a terrible thing. How good is the foil? How good, if there is one, of the comedic sidekick? Forget music or storyline or anything else. It's like who is he working with and does it help? Prowse is good. I think she's one of the better.
And they had real sparks. I gather they had an affair too while they were they were making
Method.
The movie. But some of that is true. I think there was also a conscious attempt. What we need to remember is that the rock and roll was still very much in its infancy at that point, and at least in show business. Everyone was convinced that this was a fad, that it was going to disappear, and that Elvis was kind of a cash cow who, if he was going to outlive the fad, they had to try to transform him
Correct.
Into something else. And what they were looking at was really trying to achieve a lighter, younger Dean Martin or
something like
presence
that.
Like that, where he is this, charming ladies guy who sings a few songs. And they saw the movies also as vehicles for selling the records.
Of course.
And all of that. Of these films, that's part of what went on there. But I don't think we can let Elvis entirely off the hook on that, because he was 25 at the time. He was old enough to assert some control over what he was doing, and even when he had if you want to do something instructive, Blue Suede Shoes was re-recorded for the G.I. Blues soundtrack. listen to the original recording that he did in 56, listen to the one he did in 60, and then listen when he revisited in the 68 comeback special. And you can tell, there's a valley there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really did not care at all, didn't put any of the fire into it.
And we start shoving him into a studio with studio musicians who may or may not have the rock savvy, but they could play anything.
Well, and some of that also was the, you know, the contempt for what he was doing on the part of Hollywood. You know, the musicians, even going back to Love Me Tender, mm-hmm. the people who were backing him, you know, his original group of Scotty Moore and Bill Black and DJ Fontana auditioned to be his backup band in Love Me Tender. And the producers said, no, you're not country enough. So instead they got, you know, Hollywood studio musicians, you know, who were all but wearing sunglasses during a, you know, a 1860 Civil War drama.
Right,
but,
exactly.
Yeah.
And by, remember, McKenna, as Bruno Kirby said in Spinal Tap, this is a fad. So,
yeah.
I know, that's unfortunate. All right, next.
1960, Flaming Star.
Another good director. It's Don Siegel. He had already done Invasion of the Body Snatchers and would later work with Clint Eastwood famously in Dirty Harry, Escape from Alcatraz, Coogan's Bluff.
And actually acted for Eastwood
and
Play Misty for Me, played the bartender,
that's
if
right.
I remember correctly.
And
yeah.
This was the guy who had a reputation of getting, and kind of Clint would also imitate it, get it in on time and under budget, and they for the most part would leave you alone. And Barbara Eden was in it. I always had a soft spot for Barbara Eden, and this was kind of a serious Western where he played the, for lack of a better term, the half-breed who has to decide which side he's going to fall upon.
Yeah, it's very much a product of that period. I mean, there are civil rights implications there, too, you know, a statement about prejudice. Long before it got to Elvis, I think it was originally conceived as a vehicle for Brando. And, you know, they worked their way down the pecking order,
right,
as it were, at that time. But he turns in, you know, a really credible performance. You get the sense, and I think it was Pauline Kael who said, if he had used this in King Creole as building blocks, he could have had a serious film career. And you always get the sense that was the ambition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he originally had not wanted to even sing in the movies, and because he had contempt for the musical as an art form, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
and all of that, and, you know, found quickly that nobody, at least initially, was going to pay him at least the sums that Colonel Parker was asking for if he wasn't going to sing.
Yeah,
so,
that's unfortunate.
And they shoehorned, you know, the one weakness to that film, it's actually very, very taut, but because of that imperative, they sort of shoehorned four songs into
that.
It, where literally it is, okay, we're stopping now for a musical interlude.
Yep.
The story will pick back up in a moment.
It's like the films of the 40s when the big band would get a cameo, like Cab
yeah.
Calloway.
Yeah.
Or my favorite, it doesn't really stop the story, but I love Duke Ellington's cameo in Anatomy of a Murder,
yeah,
playing piano with Jimmy Stewart. It's just but yeah, it is one of those things where, okay, a musical interlude, go get popcorn.
Yes, yeah.
All right, next.
61, Wild in the Country.
Another ambitious project. Yeah.
Troubled man, and he's got, I believe, if I remember right, three girls to choose from. So it's a serious version of Spin Out. You have the nice girl, the trashy girl, and I think the teacher, librarian, that, you know, all of them want to help him, and or he needs comfort in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
You know, it's not his East of Eden, but it's kind of that troubled youth falling upon.
Well, it's close. He's right. You know, he's a rejected by his birth family, as it were. And in this one, you know, he's you know, there are all sorts of, you know, there are evocations of him as a would-be William Faulkner or Thomas Wolfe. He's a southern writer, although I think the thing is set, has all of these sort of southern atmospherics, but if I remember right, it's set in New England. So, you know, which means his accent seems, you
right,
know, slightly out of place. But you know, there is a resonance also to that performance as well. But the problem that it had and Flaming Star had is neither one of them did well at the box office.
Yeah, I think that, and that's a shame because, you know, the...
They made money, but they didn't make tons of money.
Yeah, and that would become a thing that would later anchor the rest of that film. And by the way, shout out to Tuesday Weld. I've always liked Tuesday Weld.
Well, and that, I mean, that cast may be the only one that really could stand toe-to-toe with the King Creole cast.
Exactly. So, yeah. All right, next.
Same year, Blue Hawaii.
Well, now the travelogues begin.
Yeah.
First off, the better of the two Hawaiian films by default.
Three Hawaiian films.
Oh, that's right. Three.
Girls. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Of course, my other favorite snarky thing is, of course, his mother. He comes from a wealthy family, but he just wants to live on the beach and have a rock and roll lifestyle. Well, studio version of rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah.
And does not want to deal with Big Daddy or Big Mama. And in this case, Big Mama is played by Angela Lansbury, who apparently was 9 years old when she had her son, when she had her son Lawrence Harvey at the same age in the Manchurian Candidate.
Yes, yeah. No, it's it's one of those guilty pleasure movies because it really isn't very good in any way. You know, the whole exercise, I guess, at some level is redeemed by... you know, the song, most famous song associated with it, Can't Help Falling in Love, which is a classic.
Yes.
And the performance is beautifully modulated and all of that, and sort of became Elvis's anthem, his thank you to his fans.
Correct.
But, you know, the whole thing, he's not believable. The situation is not believable. And you literally can see it's like, okay, we've got however many weeks they take to shoot this thing, how many different Hawaiian backdrops can we work in here? You know, we've paid for these cameras. By God, we're going to use them.
Did they shoot? They shot some of that on location, right?
Yeah, so they did. He did the benefit performance there at the same time.
That's right.
Yeah.
I have a favorite moment of that was my wife was in the room with me. I was watching it one afternoon. And anytime I can get Lynn to look up from her laptop, mm-hmm. you know, just to notice something, it's a big deal. If she hears somebody or she recognizes, she'll kind of stop. And Angela Lansbury's first scene as the kvetching mother, wondering what's wrong with her son, and, you know, her and her husband, son and husband shouldn't fight. And she stops writing, watches the scene. And Angela does as best she can and, you know, runs off. And my wife just goes back to her laptop and says, even she can't make this crap sound good.
No. Well, and it's also the beginning of the truly, you know, like the song has become kind of a punchline with several of my friends and me, Rockahula Baby, and that scene has to be...
Look it up on YouTube.
Has to be seen to be believed. And the thing is, I mean, there is something that is oddly moving about watching that, because you can tell at that point the guy was still trying to make it work.
Yep.
You know, he's been handed this, you know, piece of fertilizer. And
I was going to say make chicken salad.
Yeah, he's been here, and he's really trying to make it something watchable, and, you know, it's like he narrowly misses and just goes flying off a cliff. So at that point, I'm not sure I can describe it any more fully than that.
Meanwhile, on the and that became a story, like, I don't know how well you know the films of Cliff Richard, which is kind of, he's the English Elvis, and it was very, you know, The Young Ones was similar to that, of he came from a wealthy family, but he wants to, you know, his father is played by Robert Morley. I love cinematic gene pools.
Yeah.
You know, and they're going to tear down the youth club, so he's going to...
Well, Sean Connery and Harrison Ford, too.
And
Sean Connery,
Dustin Hoffman, Matthew Broderick, and Family Business.
Yeah.
We'll do that later, another show, Cinematic Gene Pools. But yeah, but it's similar, you know, saving the youth center by putting on a show because you're ashamed of your rich lifestyle. So yeah, that's the travelogues begin. Next.
1962, Follow That Dream.
Yeah.
Not as many songs. I don't remember a performance in it.
And
although
a comedic
I'm sure there
gift.
Is.
Yeah, well, there are. There are There are several. I mean, he does follow that dream, which is one of the better Elvis songs.
Generally, it's like the title track plays over the credits, and that's
yeah.
That's about
and
it.
He does on top of Old Smokey.
Oh gosh,
and,
yeah.
And a couple of others. But again, it is, and it's a comedy, and he shows some comedic chops there.
Yeah,
and
this was a family that I think what they declared the land in Florida their own country, and you know just wanted to be left alone. And yeah, he's actually good in that.
Well, and it's odd because his character, you know, in some ways the closest point of comparison would be like Jethro on the Beverly Hillbillies, but it's a much more subtle kind of take. Mm-hmm. And when Max Baer Jr. was doing the whole, he couldn't help kind of winking at the audience, saying, "I'm just playing a character here. I'm really not." Like with Elvis, there was a real kind of sweetness and innocence to the performance that even with something like that, he could have built.
Yep.
He could have built on it.
So we have a little bit of range between the musical stuff and the troubled, you know, the angst-ridden stuff, and then the touch-it light comedy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I always remember there was, I guess, a famous story that Tom Petty got to meet Elvis because they shot it down in...
Oh, that's right, down in Florida.
Down in Florida. And nice locations. And that was another one. I don't think we saw a lot of the Everglades or the non-beach portions of Florida. You know, usually that was saved for... Where the boys are, the spring break movies.
Well, and we're going to get to perhaps one of the great Elvis movie moments in a little while. Another film set in Florida, Clambake.
Yes, we'll get to that.
Where you look in the concluding scene where Elvis's character proclaims his love for Shelley Fabre's character, and you look over the hero's shoulder and you see mountains, real Florida mountains in the background.
Like the mountains of Muncie, Indiana. Yeah,
that's
in Close
it.
Encounters,
you got it.
Or
you
the,
got it.
The Illinois mountains in The Fugitive, or
you
the mountains in Rumble in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Thank you, Vancouver. So,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Next.
62 again, Kid Galahad.
Another
decent film.
Remake of the boxing picture. And your trainer is a non-psychotic Charles Bronson. And
Gig Young?
Appears to be non-soused Gig Young.
Yeah.
Decent.
It is. It's actually one of my, favorites to watch because, again, everything seems relaxed. It,
mm-hmm.
The performances are assured. Elvis is believable in character. I gather that the guy who did the training for the boxing did not find him particularly gifted, which is a little surprising given all the karate he'd done and the mm-hmm. fact that he seemed to be, naturally gifted at movement and all of that sort of stuff. But it doesn't communicate on screen. I mean, the boxing sequences are believable. The romance with Joan Blackman's character is a lot more natural and unforced than... They had, like this brother-sister thing going on in Blue Hawaii that was mildly disturbing.
Yes.
And, here it seems much more natural.
Yeah. So underplayed, good bench. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A well done one. Very good.
Yeah.
Next.
Finishing out 62 with Girls, Girls, Girls.
That's right.
Back to Hawaii.
Stella Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there after a while like,
was
I,
it Jeremy? Is it Stevens? Is the actor who sort of plays the foil?
I think so. I don't need Elvis in like danger or seeking treasure.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's I'm pretty good with not having those, which we'll get to later in the decade.
Yeah.
But shoot it on location with pretty girls and kind of throw a story in there as an afterthought.
Well, and it had Return to Sender, another
that was his last charting hit until 68, 69.
Well, no, because
major charting.
Yeah, because he there's an interlude that wasn't associated with the movies. Actually, Crying in the Chapel.
That's right.
Charted in 65. But yeah, and it's a Bumps Blackwell song and all of that. You saw far fewer of those top flight songwriters actually being associated with many of these films, too. So in addition to the movies not being as good, the music also wasn't as good, and you know he, and you could tell he was becoming bored with
yep.
it too.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's not one of my favorites. In part, you know, you talk about Elvis looking for treasure, with perhaps one exception. Elvis singing children's songs to children. Just doesn't seem, you know.
Yeah, we'll get to my daughter in a little bit.
Yeah, well, and it's and you could tell that's another thing they decided that there was a sequence in G.I. Blues where he did a puppet show.
Puppet show.
And he sang Wooden Heart, which was never a huge hit in the United States, but apparently just exploded in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, oh, there's money to be made from doing this. So that became sort of the trend of having him repeatedly in films sing to small children.
Thanks, Bean Counters.
Yes.
All right, next.
1963, It Happened at the World's Fair.
We are continuing our travelogue. The travelogue
and children trip, again,
and
too.
Children, yes, right. And Yvonne Craig,
mm-hmm.
Batgirl for you guys out there. And he's a crop duster. All crop dusters should look like 60s Elvis Presley.
and have the kind of wardrobes, too.
That's true. Well-dressed crop dusters.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was... I know a little bit about expensive clothing, and I could tell you, you know, the only crops that produce that kind of cash are generally illegal. So.
I think they were the Winter Kills producers.
Yeah.
And I think also this wasn't this for a lot of people the introduction to the world? I mean, instead of watching the 10-minute short about the World's Fair, you got a movie about the World's Fair.
Yes. And, you know, it was the Space Needle was relatively new. You got shots of that. You know, about the best I can say about that movie is it isn't the worst of them. But you really began to see a serious slide here because it's like there's not even a song there ultimately to redeem the
I remember the,
movie. The
song Relax. That's the one where he's trying to seduce Yvonne Craig and she shows a little bit of physical humor. Being basically the cat in the Pepe Le Pew cartoons.
Yeah.
The other trivia note, ladies and gentlemen, is at the World's Fair, he falls for a nurse.
Joan O'Brien.
And in order to get closer to the nurse, he hires a kid. He gives a kid a nickel to kick him in the shins so he can go and see the nurse. And that kid was played by?
Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Who later played Elvis in a TV miniseries. And the performance, Kurt Russell's performance is phenomenal.
Kurt Russell has acted with Elvis, played Elvis, played an Elvis impersonator, and done voiceover for Elvis in Forrest Gump.
Yes.
So, and there's more Kurt Russell trivia involving this later. So, but otherwise pretty forgettable.
Yeah.
Next.
Fun in Acapulco.
Not shot in Acapulco.
No.
The two things for me with this. One
Elvis and Kids again.
Elvis and Kids. Ursula Andress.
Yeah.
Or as my dad always said, Ursula Undress.
I know.
Because my dad is of a generation.
Yeah.
But when my daughter was into watching Elvis movies, I actually used a scene from I did an anatomy of a scene with Fun in Acapulco because it's the scene where he's a former circus trapeze artist and there was an accident because it's flashbacks and serious music and Elvis goes to the pool and he sees the diving board and and serious music is playing and they cut to Elvis and they cut to the board and then we get a flashback and I talked Emma through this and she's like, oh, you know, I saw her little cinematic light bulb go off and I went, I can't believe we did Anatomy of a Scene, not with Bergman, not with Scorsese or Coppola. No, it was an Elvis movie, and this one of all of them.
Yeah, and this one was probably, you know, that they all fall into there. At this point, with perhaps one, maybe two exceptions going forward, we're talking about misses rather than
same
hits.
Same film three times a year.
Yeah, but this one has a special because it's like the biggest missed opportunity because it is a substantial cast, you know, of attractive and talented rising stars. I mean, Ursula Andress,
No.
Yeah, she had just done Dr. No. That, you know, she was considered a huge emerging talent at that point. Alejandro Rey was in it.
That's right.
He played kind of the foil. He, you know, Elvis had someone to work against who could hold the screen with him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just didn't work, in part because, unlike King Creole or even, you know, Blue Hawaii, it's set in Acapulco. And apparently, you know, there was some controversy. Supposedly something had, a quote had been misappropriated to him that seemed to denigrate Mexicans. Okay. And they had security concerns about shooting down there. Although one might wonder, given the Machiavellian nature of the Colonel
Parker's
saying,
it's
more expensive to go down there. We can shoot in this parking lot right here, and everything will be just fine because it's Elvis.
Look up the Colonel's passport. That'll help.
Explain it. Yeah.
All right. Next.
64 Kissin' Cousins.
Oh, this is one of the worst. This is a musical based on the Patty Duke Show.
Yeah.
The army wants a section of some of the hill country, and Elvis is going to help out because he has an identical blonde cousin, which there's a little peak of sadness because you think about his twin dying at birth, and I wondered how much of that, if it any, resonated.
Well, and I think also that movie, you know, conforms to the worst stereotypes of Appalachian whites.
Makes little Abner look like Tennessee Williams.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's real. That's the part of the country, the cultural landscape that my mother's people come from. So, you know, I watch that, and, you know, I mean, one presumes with a name like Presley and all of that, that's part of the cultural landscape that he came from. You know, the humor is incredibly forced, and what there is of it, it's always the hill people who are the butt of the joke.
Yep.
There is a reason, I think, that he hated making that movie. He hated wearing the wig.
Yeah, there was also I don't remember if they did a split screen like on the Patty Duke Show, but there was always somebody, some double with the back to the camera.
Lance LeGault, and there's actually a pretty famous scene near the end of it when they're shooting the big finale.
Okay.
And this was, you know, a production of Sam Katzman, whose nickname was Sam Quickie Katzman.
Yes.
Because he did films really, really briskly. And really, really cheaply. And, you know, so the Colonel had found his guy there.
Oh, God.
And there is a scene where they're shooting the big finale where everybody's singing, you know, and I think the camera guy missed the shot or whatever, and you can see there's Elvis and there's Lance LeGault standing side by side, and you can tell clearly that it's Lance LeGault. Somebody points it out. Katzman says, no, I don't want to spend the money to get it again. So it goes out that way. The whole thing was shot in 3 weeks.
Oof, gosh, and it shows.
It does.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, at the time this film, nobody had planned on home video.
Yeah.
That it was just going to air. And even if somebody had a quick eye and went, is that? You just move on. You couldn't find it again unless it came on TV. And again, you didn't have a pause button.
Well, and, you know, the amazing thing is the film that she's going to talk about next, Viva Las Vegas, Call Us On, actually was shot before Kissin' Cousins.
It's that they went through it that fast.
And part of it, we'll talk about the implications of this sequence, because this is really the point when Elvis's film career just jumps the rails completely.
And with that in mind, next.
Viva Las Vegas.
Of the frothy comic musicals that he would pump out three times a year, this is the best.
By far.
By far.
By far. You know, it co-stars Anne Margaret.
The last real, well, up until, and we'll get to a couple other actresses, but the last real actress that could stand toe-to-toe when it came to performance, singing, sexuality, comedy. I mean, they bounced off each other really, really well, on and off.
And they had, tremendous chemistry. They had an affair as well. which I gather was sort of a commonplace for him.
An actor having an affair with a leading lady.
It's a, you know, as I said to a friend once who was going through a divorce and bought a waterbed and all of that, I said, you know, you're one set of neck chains away from becoming a cliche. in this case, it worked in part because it also, the pacing was incredibly brisk. Mm-hmm. You could tell he cared about what he was doing. I think one of the best moments we have of him on film is when he's in that scene where he thinks he has lost Anne Margaret. And, you know, he's not acting. Initially, there's kind of a voiceover performance of a ballad. I need somebody to lean on. But he is conveying all of the confusion and the pain and the hurt and all of that. And you realize, you know, if this guy had been given good material, he could have been something special. Mm-hmm. You know, which gets to your point, about the great might have been's. As much as he accomplished, moments like that tell us that it could have been a heck of a lot more.
And that film did well. It didn't do great. And because I was a commentary track on this, but because it wasn't a monster hit, Colonel Parker went back to Sam and just started pumping out.
Yeah, well, and there was a lot going on at the point that came out. In part, the Colonel was not on board with having, you know, Elvis share the screen with other strong presences because
crazy.
Yeah, he in fact was complaining all the way through the production that Anne Margaret was getting too much screen time, and all of that. But the other thing that was going on is at this point, you know, Elvis had been the biggest star in music for close to a decade. And he had his first really serious threat. The Beatles had arrived in America.
I remember, what was it? I'm sure there have been several articles, and you can find those, of what songs the Beatles were doing that year and what songs Elvis were doing that year. And you see the writing on the wall of that.
Yeah.
That's a fun. And by the way, after this one, I'm good with no races. No racing pretty much for the rest of whatever. Also, with the power of the pause button, they do a really fun duet of What I Say. And in the gymnasium, one of the dancers in the very front, if you push pause, a young Terry Garr.
Yes, she did several of those.
Several of those, yeah. So I don't know. I have to look if she's been interviewed talking about those. I'd like to figure out how she got involved.
I think she was, when she did a David Letterman show years ago, she talked about being in several of the Elvis movies.
Cool, I'll have to find that. All right, so yeah, that's one. Here we go. Next.
Roustabout.
I actually like this. It's another example of, apparently Colonel Parker never played tennis.
Yeah.
Because you need somebody equal or better to bounce off of. And he got a chance to work off Barbara Stanwyck, and it's not bad. It's a carnival story about the troubled 20-something working in the carnival. But I like the work he did with Stanwyck.
Yeah, well, and when I watched that film, I can't even remember the actress's name, the young ingenue type that Elvis is supposed to be in love with, in part because even when I watched it when I was young, I thought, why is he chasing after this little girl when Barbara Stanwyck is available?
Why?
And, you know, that would have been a bold and interesting choice. To go with that route. You know, again, and that, it shows, you know, one of the big musical moments there is, you know, he does an old R&B hit, Little Egypt, and does it with conviction. It comes back again, obviously, in the 68 comeback special.
Yep.
And I think that album was the last one to go to number one for him, maybe in the 60s. I mean, even the stuff at American Studios and all of that, I don't think topped the charts. I don't think he got back to number one on the album charts until Aloha from Hawaii.
Wow. That's a, and there's some, there's some good stuff in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes. Yeah. So. Really good.
There you go. That's part one of my discussion of the filmography of Elvis Presley with John Krull, the host of No Limits. We got a couple minutes left in the show, and we didn't plan it. It just happened this way. But DJ Fontana, Elvis Presley's original drummer, passed away last week. So as a way of saluting his work as well as the theme, here's a short medley of some of the songs DJ played on. Yes, they're from the films. I know about the great recordings that Elvis, that DJ played on with Elvis, but it fits the spirit. So enjoy.
He goes by the name of King Creole. You know he's gone, 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 jumping like King catfish Creole, on a pole. Yeah. You know he's gone, 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 out of hip shaking King Creole. When the king starts to do it, it's as good as done. He holds his skin tall like a Tommy gun. He starts to growl without any throat. He bends a string and that saw she wrote. You know he's gone, 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 jumping like a catfish on a pole.
Give us a room with a view of the beautiful Rhine. Give us a room with a view of the beautiful Rhine. Give me a mighty old creek in Texas, any old time. I got those hop, two, three, four, occupation G.I. blues. From my G.I. hat to the heels of my G.I. shoes. And if I don't go stateside soon, I'm gonna blow my fuse. We'll get hoss and pfeffer and black pumpernickel for chow. Bright light city, gonna set my soul, gonna set my soul on fire. Got a whole lot of money that's ready to burn, so get those stakes up higher. There's a thousand pretty women waiting out there. They're all living the devil may care. And I'm just a devil with love to spare. So viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas! How I wish that there were more than the 24 hours in the day. Even if there were 40 more, I wouldn't sleep a minute away. Oh, there's blackjack and poker and the roulette wheel. A fortune won and lost on every deal. All you need is a strong heart and a new steel. Viva!
There's a little film medley of Elvis music featuring DJ Fontana on the drums. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go check out an Elvis movie. You deserve it. Just be careful which one you pick. Part two of this epic discussion with John Krull will air on next week's show. So until next time, take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!